Welcome to Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 15 for August 19th, 2009. I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting and the Weekly Leader Podcast and blog. And my podcasting partner is Pam Fox-Rolland from IdeaShape. Hey, Pam, it's been a while.
It's been a very busy summer, personally and professionally, and I suspect it's been that for you, too.
Yeah, it's been great. We went to England for a few weeks to see family and friends, and been back and been busy with been all kinds of things going on here, professionally and personally. So it's been a crazy, crazy summer.
Well, the last 2 weeks have been showing up in my voice, so I'll just acknowledge that the problem is not with your iPod. The problem is with my voice. I want to sound like Kathleen Turner, but I think I'm sounding like a squeaky fifth grader. The last couple of weeks, I've spent a lot of time in air-conditioned conference rooms and planes. I think this has been the outcome of it. But I thought there's a couple things that I wanted to share with our listeners in those journeys.
Cool.
So in week before last, I was in planes and very air-conditioned conference rooms in Dallas for a really exciting conference. Exciting because I love learning as much as I can from research and practice. And this focus of this are for professionals who work with Myers-Briggs type and related instruments. And so it was the biannual meeting of the Association for Psychological Type. And I had the pleasure of keynoting that conference 4 years ago. And this year got to do a session that was fun. It created a bunch of buzz. So our email is now full with requests for the materials, and we're thinking about what to do with it. But my partner in crime in this is Dario Nardi, who is on the faculty of the Human Performance Lab at UCLA and is a cognitive science guy. And his findings, 2 years of research so far, are showing that how people's brains are active. So what's going on in their neocortex is very much influenced by Myers-Briggs type or correlated with Myers-Briggs type, much more so than by gender. So for all the conversations about the female brain, et cetera, his findings are very fascinating to those of us who have studied Myers-Briggs and similar models over the years. And just to see in brain maps how differently people of different types use their brains. So I will keep you posted. I imagine some of our listeners are interested in Myers-Briggs, may have experienced a program or maybe practitioners, and I will be happy to keep you informed as the research and our writing about it progresses.
Excellent. And, you know, maybe we can do a special episode about it because it's an area that, though I've had experience and contact with, it's not my expertise, but I know it's something that you are an expert in and probably be worthwhile to share that knowledge with our listeners.
Cool. Good.
Well, we've been off for a while. The last podcast we did was with Marty Linsky, part one. But before that, because we took a summer hiatus, we put together a little best of episode. And did you listen to that one?
Oh, yeah.
Wanted to give people a taste for some of what they might be able to hear. Hopefully, we'll pick up some listeners as a result of that. You know, we start out with Peter Aceto, the CEO of ING Direct, and we've had some great leaders all the way through to Jay Rogers from Local Motors, who had a lot of interesting things to say. All of them did. And so we took a quote from a little excerpt from each one of their interviews and packaged it into one podcast. So if you haven't listened to it, you might want to check it out. But it's a good one to point people to if they're not regular listeners yet and you want to give them a taste of the show. We also last few days, we did a special edition of Weekly Leader with Mary Michaela Weber's Voice Empowerment, and she did a little less than 10 minutes, on making speeches come alive. So we put that in the feed, and that came out as a separate podcast in the feed. Hope people find some valuable information in there, and Mary Michaela's going to be a regular contributor. I think that's her second segment. So we also have gotten some feedback over the last month or so from a couple different people. We have a Google Voice widget on the podcast blog, and Mia Chambers, who's a friend from Facebook and Twitter, actually put a comment in there, and so we know it worked. We appreciate her getting in there and showing us how it can work. We also got a comment this week from Steve Rosler from All Things Workplace, which was our Weekly Leader blog of the week last week, and he just thanked us for highlighting his blog. So we appreciate him coming back and commenting on ours. And finally, we have that Scribd little widget on the side of the podcast blog that asks for ideas or topics for future podcasts. And somebody anonymous came in there and said they'd like to have an episode or a segment at least on the stress of unemployment or fear of your group being fired. So what do you think of that one, Pam?
Well, the fear of your group being fired, I think, is a really meaty leadership topic and actually might be worth addressing after you finish the adaptive leadership series, because, boy, is that an adaptive challenge to having your team operate productively in an environment where they're under that much fear.
Yeah, definitely. And that might be one we want to bring Ed Brenniger back in for. Maybe you and Ed can do a little segment on that as well, because that seems to be right in Ed's wheelhouse. So thank you for the whoever anonymous is. Thank you for the contribution. And we will definitely put together a segment on that topic. We have this week's weekly leader blog of the week. And we've typically gone in the direction of probably more high-profile bloggers like Tom Peters. I think he was a blog of the week. At least he was on the Weekly Leader blog, maybe not on the podcast yet. Last week we said we'd add Steve Rosler. This week we wanted to give people a look at a blog that they might not be familiar with. It's one that's been in my reader for a while, and it's Professor Michael Roberto's blog. The byline is Musings About Leadership, Decision-Making, and Competitive Strategy. The way he explains himself on the blog is, I am a professor of management at Bryant University in Smithfield, Rhode Island. I joined the faculty at Bryant after 6 years as a faculty member at Harvard Business School. I've spent time as a visiting professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. My research, teaching, and consulting focuses on strategic decision-making processes and senior management teams. And he has a couple books. Most recent one is Know What You Don't Know, How Great Leaders Prevent Problems Before They Happen. And that's from Wharton School Publishing, dated 2009. And he also has another book, Why Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer, Managing for Conflict and Consensus. I enjoy the blog. Good short posts about leadership, very incisive, always interesting. I know this week he had a post about an editorial that he and another professor wrote for Washington Post, I believe it was. So anyway, I want to just point people in the direction of something they might not have found on their own, might not be familiar with. It's Professor Michael Roberto's blog. We'll have the URL in the show notes.
So, Peter, I wasn't familiar with it, so I'm really glad that you brought it to my attention, too. And I just love he commented on and has a link to some research on CEO compensation and gaming the competitive set so that they're really considering the compensation of CEOs of larger organizations or ones that are outliers and skewing the pay higher. He's actively looking at the research, and I will be following his blog. Thanks for the recommendation.
Excellent. Sake good order. I mean, I haven't read either of his books here, but they both sound interesting to me. So hopefully maybe we can get him on here and be a guest sometime. Then we also like to talk a little bit about things in the news and social media and leadership. And I just came across my desk just before we were planning to go online. I got something from the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was. Yeah, it was. And it's called Dig Dialogue with Tim Geithner. And basically, Tim Geithner is going to be interviewed by Alan Murray, who's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And the way they're going to get the questions to Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, is to use Dig. So you can submit your questions through Dig, or you can vote, as most people probably will be familiar with Dig. But if you're not, it's a social network that allows people to vote on stories, to raise the awareness of the stories. In this instance, questions that will be submitted for Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, will actually be voted on, and those will be the ones he'll answer. So it's kind of an interesting use of social media for a leader to get a message out there.
As you know, that teed up something for me. I've been following this week the events with John Mackey, the Whole Foods CEO, who did an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal last week on healthcare. And it raises, the whole situation raises so many leadership issues that either I'll blog about it or maybe, Peter, we can devote a few future podcasts to it. Have you been hearing about, following this story?
Yeah, a little bit. Maybe not quite as much as you have, but I a little bit. So go ahead.
Well, let me give just the contours of it. So he did a blog post, or rather a post for the Wall Street Journal opinion piece, which they changed the heading to make it really quite radical, pointed heading. Anyway, people are having all sorts of reactions to this post on healthcare, which many of his recommendations fall in line with his views that he describes as libertarian. And you've got other parts of the Whole Foods organization trying to backpedal a little bit and say, okay, those are the views of the CEO. They're not necessarily the views of Whole Foods. And meanwhile, you've got customers who have very different perspectives on healthcare. Some of them are organizing boycotts, et cetera. And it tees up just really fascinating issues about to what extent does the CEO speak for the firm. And one thing that is sort of buried in this discussion is CEO's use of social media, which I know, Peter, is a huge issue for you of interest. And you've talked with Peter Aceto, the CEO of Indirect, about how he uses Twitter and Facebook, and with Thad Allen, the head of the Coast Guard, and the several other, you know, folks that have been a part of these weekly leader interviews. I'm recalling that all of those used social media in their own name. Is that your recollection as well?
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously transparency and probably authenticity in both of their uses of social media. And most of the people that we've talked to so far that do use it, I think Jay Rogers as well from Local Motors, yeah, this is definitely some transparency and authenticity in all of their uses.
Yeah, so it was shocking for me to find out that for 8 years, John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, had been posting on Yahoo Finance under Rahodeb, which is kind of a backwards version of his wife's name. And amazingly, he was talking up Whole Foods stock and trashing Wild Oats, one of their biggest competitors, to the point of the Wild Oats stock share price going down and Whole Foods actually, you know, eventually bought them. And this stuff came to light in the FTC filings when Whole Foods bought the bought Wild Oats. And to me, it is astonishing that the board would keep in place a CEO who engaged in that use of PR, that kind of deceptive use. And there's a quote from a former SEC commission, although I guess with Madoff has sort of taken the luster off the title of former SEC commissioner. This is from Harvey Pitt. You know, for an executive to use a pseudonym to praise his company and stock isn't per se unlawful, but it's bizarre and ill-advised, even if it isn't illegal. So this guy has a really odd history of how he sees his PR role for the company. And if, you know, our Weekly Leader podcast listeners are interested in it, definitely comment on it, share your views, make some suggestions, because I will be doing either some writing about it or, Peter, if you're up for it, we'll do some podcasting on it.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Obviously, so many leaders out there have strong opinions, and this does certainly bring up all kinds of interesting opportunities for discussion. I did see briefly a posting that I didn't read in full detail, but what I did find interesting about it was that his editorial in the Wall Street Journal was originally a post on his blog, and another blog actually took both, and kind of like when you use Microsoft Word to compare documents,
right,
they were able to compare the two documents, and there were some substantial editing changes between the two. I'm not in a position to make any kind of judgment, and I right now say that I don't know anything about the blog that did that analysis, so I don't know if what if they're liberal or conservative or whatever, and I frankly don't know, but it was interesting to see how the piece the essay evolved from his blog into the editorial. So anyway, I think it'd be a great idea to kind of look at leaders and their uses of social media and transparency and authenticity. I think that would be a great subject for us to explore. And certainly this example would be forefront. So we had Marty Linsky on last week. Any quick thoughts before we listen to part two of Dr. Ed Brenniger and my interview with Marty? Any quick thoughts do you have about
Yeah, just highlight two things from part one, which was so excellent. That really stood out for me. One is him chiding Ed on using leader as a noun rather than some sort of active leadership, which Linsky likes to think about as a verb. And it sounds like a tiny thing, but I really understand why Marty Linsky focuses on it. And I would say in working with all different sorts of organizations, there are so many people who are not ready to claim the title of leader. And I find this even in working with the MBA students at Stanford Business School, many of whom come there because it's got a strong leadership program, et cetera. But they say, well, okay, I'm not a leader because blah, blah, blah. And I think that's fascinating for a couple reasons. One is because, as he said, leadership is difficult and dangerous work. So some people shy away from wanting to be, you know, it's kind of like Survivor. The first person that emerges as a leader is voted off the island, right? So sure. They don't want to claim the title. But the second reason is that we can have some pretty restrictive notions of what a leader looks like, and they tend to be trait-based and personality-based instead of actually being based on the action. And what I really appreciate about Linsky's work is it highlights on the behavior of leadership, which is to help a group grapple with tough challenges in a really productive way and move the needle on those challenges. So I admire that distinction, although I'm sure I won't erase the word leader from my vocabulary.
No, I agree with you. And in July, actually, my leadership column for Marine News Magazine, the title of the column was Leadership is Not a Job Title. And I start out in that writing, over my long business career, I've never received a business card from a person with the title leader. I can't even remember anyone introducing themselves to me by saying, "Hi, I'm Sally, and I'm a leader of XYZ Inc." Leadership is not a role or title. It's an action or activity, and it can and should be exercised at all levels of the organization. Unfortunately, this is not always the case. So, I'm a bit of a disciple of the Heifetz-Linsky school there. So I'm a huge supporter of the concept of leadership as an activity or an action rather than a role, which is more aligned with the concept of authority. So let's listen to what Marty has to say in part two of our interview with him. I had the great fortune 2 years ago to spend a week with you at Harvard in a program, a life-changing program really, called The Art and Practice of Leadership Development. And it was an incredible experience. And a big part of that experience, a couple of things that came away with me from that experience was the idea that really to bring about effective change, you have to turn up the heat. You use a pressure cooker analogy in the book and in the course as well. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we think that thinking of yourself as having your hand on the thermostat is a critical tool in exercising leadership. Now, you don't turn up the heat as an end in itself, but from our perspective, there is what we call a productive zone of disequilibrium. There's tremendous pressure in the status quo. We often say that there's no such thing as a dysfunctional family or organization or community because every family or organization or community is perfectly organized to get the result it is currently getting. And in that sense, it's not dysfunctional. It's actually a product of a lot of people's preferences. So we try and think about what it takes to change a system that has a lot of investment in it. And in our experience and observation, the only way you can do that is to begin to make people uncomfortable, that so that they begin to feel the discomfort of the pressure that you're putting in the system more than they feel the comfort of the status quo. And that's a very hard thing. I mean, we work with a lot of people who are wonderful, sweet people, and the idea that they're in the business of disturbing people is very provocative to them. And yet we think that's a critical element of exercising leadership. So we talk about moving organizations, moving groups, moving teams into a productive zone of disequilibrium where the pressure to make change is more powerful than the pressure to keep the status quo.
And as a result of that, you talk a bit about the book and experienced it actually at the program, is that there can be casualties as a result of this, this
process.
Yeah,
it's a very difficult subject to talk about. It's particularly difficult in the nonprofit sector, where people are so oriented to be helpers and nurturers. But we don't think, we think one of the reasons that there isn't more exercise, leadership exercise, is because there are almost always casualties. There are almost always people who are going to be left behind, who are simply not going to be able to make it through. That's one of the reasons that people back off, because they recognize that there are those problems out there, that not everybody is going to be able to make it. So we believe that if you recognize, if you're trying to exercise leadership, and if you recognize that there are some people who are actually going to be behind, you know, whenever anybody says to me this is going to be a win-win, then I know nothing really important is going to happen. But if you recognize that some people are going to be left behind, then two good things happen. First of all, you're likely to actually allocate time and resources to helping them get through, to helping them make a transition, to help them get on with lives in some way. But the second thing, which I think is from a strategic point of view even more important, is what happens is that people who are watching you all the time when you're trying to lead change, and when they see that you are committed to dealing with, taking responsibility and dealing with the people who aren't going to make it, that is going to help them come along. That is going to give them encouragement that this might be okay, that that the people who are trying to push this change are humane and sensitive and understand the consequences of what they're doing. So we see that as a really important piece from both a strategic point of view and from a kind of humanitarian point of view, if you will.
Right. And timing is another important factor in all this. Sometimes an issue isn't ripe for change. You discussed that in the book. And what comes to mind, what comes to mind right now is and I'll just kind of leapfrog into the next question, is you know, President Obama is tackling a lot of issues head on. Some of our country's most complex challenges, you know, one that comes to mind immediately is healthcare. And in your opinion, is he actually practicing adaptive leadership? And if so, is he doing it effectively?
Well, I think he's doing a pretty good job. I mean, he's, I know he's gotten a lot of criticism for trying to do too much. I look at it quite differently. I think he's not trying to do too much. I think he's running a whole lot of experiments to try to figure out which ones are ripe and which ones are going to work. And I think that's exactly what he should be doing. You know, one of the things that I admire in him is he is willing to make changes in midstream. He doesn't get stuck in a point of view. You know, I think one of the paradoxes of exercising leadership is that you have to be totally committed on the one hand, and at the same time open to the possibility that you're dead wrong. And so you take this whole issue, which is now, I think, up for grabs as a political issue about the bipartisanship. You know, he was very committed in the campaign to bipartisanship, and I think he's now rethinking that as a principle. Is that principle really that important, and am I willing to sacrifice a bill that I want, you know, on the altar of that principle? So I like that. I mean, he's done the same thing with transparency, you know. We don't want our politicians to learn. We want them to stay where they are. And transparency was a big issue for him in the campaign. But the reality is that, you know, with Guantanamo Pictures being a best example, perhaps, whenever, and of course the vetting of candidates for jobs being another one, whenever transparency clashed with something else he believed in more, he jettisoned transparency. And I think that's really admirable. I think that's what we really want in people in positions of responsibility like that, is not to be, you know, to know what's most important to them and not to be committed to a a strategy that isn't working.
Right. Yeah, and we often, I know you address this in the book as well, and we always look to our leaders to solve our problems, and when they don't, they often become scapegoats. And
right.
I know his popularity has been sky high. I think recently it's taken a little bit of a hit, but I guess that's part of the process of the dangerous process of leadership.
I think that's right, and I think he understands that. You know, I think he even spoke during the campaign about how he could never possibly fulfill the aspirations that had been poured into him by people. Not only were they overwhelming in terms of their quantity and their height, but some of them were inconsistent or even mutually exclusive. Peter, you heard me say this up at Harvard, but my favorite definition of leadership, the one that I'm really committed to, is that leadership is about disappointing your own people at a rate that they can absorb.
Yeah,
that's good.
Actually, I just would like just a couple other things. The timing issue, I'd just like to come back to that for a second as well. Could you just address that sometimes it may not be the right time for an issue to be resolved or solved?
Yeah, I think timing is really important. And in my experience, people trying to exercise leadership are so committed to the cause that they don't take into consideration those kinds of variables. But if an issue isn't ripe, if an issue isn't ready to be addressed, you've got to figure out a way, and that goes back to what we're talking about, controlling the temperature. You've got to figure out a way to raise the heat in the system so that it is. So you take, for example, I'll give you a good example. My mother is 95 years old. She still drives. She still drives at night. I don't think she should be driving at night, and I won't let her drive at night when I'm anywhere near her. But it's very important to her. It's not, you know, it is a huge adaptive challenge for her to stop driving because it's part of her self-identity. Well, I don't think my mother's alone in that situation, and I think the states are very lax on testing older people for driving. And I think they do that because there's a lot of pressure for older people to not be tested because they want to keep driving because it's important to their sense of independence, their sense of freedom, and their self-identity. So all of a sudden, there was a rash. There were four accidents in Massachusetts involving elderly drivers, including one, they're all tragic, but one unbelievably tragic one where a guy ran over his wife in the driveway. Well, all of a sudden, that issue, which has been sitting around for years, you know, all the highway safety people talk about it. I mean, it's there isn't a lack of research. Nobody argues what the facts are. But all of a sudden, that issue is now ripe because there have been four stories. Everybody's talking about it, and the opportunity to exercise leadership on that has presented itself for the first time. So that's, to me, that's a good example of what we mean.
Great.
Marty, You make a point both in the book, I'm pretty sure it's in the book, I originally was taken with it, and something you wrote on your blog about the importance of optimism and realism. And I agree with that, but I really want to focus that on a particular side of that. Is that a generational issue? Is there a facet of that which makes it easier for, in particular, the younger generations to be both more optimistic and realistic in their approach to leading?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought of it at all. That's a great question. I'd like to think about that a little bit.
Okay.
That's a great question. I think there are some generational differences that are powerful around leadership stuff. I mean, The one that is most obvious to me has to do with the control of information and privacy, and you know the millennials think about that very differently than old people like me. And this is an issue that we see in a lot of organizations as a generational issue, not as a feminist issue, but as a generational issue. But it's interesting to think about whether that whole realism-optimism balance has a generic aspect to it. Thanks.
Well, you're welcome. I raised that question because you know, I was reading, you pointed us in your blog to your son's blog that he's working on at the
right.
Stimulus, and they had posted the wedding entrance video, and I saw that as a really beautiful example of where, you know, the 20-somethings generation really is, you know, that sense of camaraderie, that sense of joy in expressing themselves, and that sense of crossing the traditional boundaries of a wedding to become something totally different. And it was really compelling to me. And I was seeing that as kind of an analogous to what can happen in organizations when you release people to be find their own level of optimism and realism through their work.
Well, I think that's really interesting. I'm excited to think about that a little bit. I'll go back and look at that and think about it. That's really interesting. I'm very provoked by that, stimulated by it.
Is in the book, again, in the model, really, you leaders or people who exercise adaptive leadership need to kind of push back or give the problem back to the people to solve it. And is in a position like the president finds himself currently, can the president actually do that? Is that possible?
Well, it's very risky for people in authority to do that generally, but particularly for someone in his position, because, of course, we really don't want politicians to give the work back to us. We want them to take it off our shoulders. We want authority figures to do that generally. You know, we want people to not tell us that we need to do the work, but to do the work for us. And so it's, I think it's very, very hard for someone in that role to do that. Saying that, I think he's talked about sacrifice, and he's talked about how this is not a problem that can be solved without people giving up something. But I don't think he's really pushed hard enough on that, because it is very risky for him, very risky. Although, you know, the only time you can really expect politicians to exercise leadership, I think, given the system that we've created, it's not their fault, we've created the system, but the only time you can really expect them to exercise leadership, I think, is in the 6 months after an election. So this is his time to do it, and I hope he has the courage and the skill to continue to take advantage of it.
What is it that you want people to know who have never thought of themselves in a leadership role to think about your book that would make them go out this afternoon and buy it?
I think it depends on purpose. So I would say to people, what is it that you care about that's not being fully realized? What are your aspirations for your organization, for your community, that aren't working the way you want them to? And then let's talk about what you could do about it. So this is really a book for people who want to exercise leadership on something they care about. That's really where it is. So that's where I start. I would start with anybody by trying to help them think about what their purpose is, what is most important to them.
The book is a tremendous resource for anybody who's interested in leadership and anybody who's professionally involved with leadership. But also on top of that, I think any type of consultant out there who tries to bring change to an organization should have this book on their bookshelf and read it. Because what I came away with in my time with you in Harvard as well was the experience of digging into a problem and getting to the root core of the problem and trying to attack it that way and not get distracted by some of the more superficial issues. And I think you do a great job. You guys do a great job in laying that out in the book. So
well, thank you very much. It's exciting. I mean, for us, the times we're in really feel to us like an opportunity to get people interested in this material that hasn't existed before, because, you know, so many people are confused, struggling, anxious about the future, and that really, you know, that really presents an opportunity for them to think about what's most important to them and how they're going to advance it.
Excellent. So how can people get in touch with you, Marty, and Cambridge Leadership Associates and all your various internet properties? We'll obviously have all this also in the blog show notes, so people will have links there.
Well, my email address is Marty, M-A-R-T-Y, at Cambridge-Leadership.com, Cambridge-Leadership.com. And we have, our website is www.cambridge-leadership.com. And we'd love to hear from people. We spend a lot of time with people, helping them think about how they can make more progress than they have and what they care about, and we welcome those opportunities.
Excellent. And you also, I know I was on earlier, and I joined it. You have a Facebook page at Cambridge Leadership Associates. A lot of our listeners are on Facebook as well. So
yeah, we're trying really hard to drag ourselves into the 21st century.
I think you're doing a great job. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today about the book and about adaptive leadership, and we look forward to the next book. Got that one in the works?
We're talking about it this week, actually, but these things take a long time to gestate.
Absolutely.
But thank you very much for your interest, and it's been great fun to talk with you.
So that was part two of Marty Linsky's interview with Dr. Ed Brenniger and me back a couple weeks ago, and as we mentioned there repeatedly, Marty and Ron Heifetz and Alexander Grasso have a new book called The Practice of Adaptive Leadership, and it was great to spend time with Marty. What are your thoughts on part two of the interview, Pam?
Sure. Well, let me just first make a note on the book. It looks like a textbook. It looks heavy. In reality, if you open the pages, and he's not paying me for saying this, if you open the pages, it is one of the most readable, client-ready books I've seen. And, you know, as I was saying to you off mic, it was a bizarre experience for me in reading this book, Peter, and realizing that, oh, a good half of what I learned in my last 20 years in strategy consulting and executive coaching is actually referenced in this book. It's an astonishing work.
Good. I'm glad you know, you had the chance to pick it up and read it too. And too bad we didn't get you on the interview. But it looks like a textbook. It actually, I mean, it's like a great textbook, because as I say in the intro there, you know, you can read it from cover to cover if you want, or they suggest you can pick it up and find the parts of it that you need. And there's lots of valuable exercises and obviously examples of successes and failures, so it's an excellent, excellent tool. And as I mentioned last week, I think it's a book that every consultant, regardless of whether you're focused on leadership or anything else, should read, because it also helps you dig into what the gist of a problem is. It kind of helps you, and that's a big part of what their program is at Harvard, is it helps you figure out how to get to the meat of a problem and how to help foster or facilitate a solution.
Let me just bring up one more thing that I heard in the interview that I thought was just a tremendous gem, and that is leadership is about disappointing your own people at a rate they can absorb. And that's so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think people go into leadership situations, especially newer, shiny leaders, thinking that if they do this really well, they're going to have everybody be happy. And it just doesn't work that way, because if you're leading people towards change, there are trade-offs and sacrifices and losses in the process. And to me, that highlights the importance as a leader of really developing your own emotional capabilities and your own ability to sit with and be present with people being upset, with people being annoyed, with keeping yourself open in the face of people challenging your views. And I think he sets up a pretty important agenda for leaders to learn in their own development so they have the capacity to deal with everything that comes along when you're leading change.
Yeah, definitely a big part of the whole model involves this concept of getting on the balcony. So it means basically you're part of a process, you're part of a system, part of a process, but sometimes you need to step up and above and actually metaphysically or something, see yourself from a different perspective and look down and distance yourself slightly from the emotional aspects of what it's like to be involved in the process, whether it's a negotiation or whatever it is, and kind of step back and step up on the balcony, rather, and have a little bit of a distance, further distance in observation to creating that distance to help you manage your emotions or get away from your emotions, because we all have them. I also found it interesting when he said it right before his quote that you just had about disappointing people at the rate that they can absorb. He said whenever he hears about win-win, he feels that nothing important is really going to happen, and there are casualties. That's why the famous line, that's why you get paid the big bucks, right? It's difficult. It's difficult and challenging, and people typically like to avoid difficult and challenging things.
One last thing that I'll highlight from the interview is we want leaders to do the work for us, and then we get angry when they don't or it doesn't turn out the way we want to. And man, that is so true. And to me, that argues for building your leadership along a certain path over time and having some patience, which is another thing that he talks about. So you've probably seen this, Peter. When people go to a leadership workshop or retreat or offsite, whether with us or with somebody else, and then they come back and they're like, okay, I'm now doing everything totally differently. Right. You own your problems. I don't, and there's so much transitioning that is wise to do, I think, of a couple months of helping people take back the ownership of their problems and grapple with it. And it's a great point to get to where really your core contribution as a leader is to enable people, create the context for people to grapple with their own problems. But they're certainly going to need some lead time to get there. At least that's my experience.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I guess, the job of the leader, to figure that out, to help them along with that process. We'd love for you to join us in the leadership conversation, and we've given you lots of ways to do that. First of all, why don't you just go over to the show blog? It's weeklyleader.net/podcast, and you can leave an audio comment there via the Google Voice widget. We'd love to integrate your voice into the show alongside Pam and mine. You can always leave a comment in one of the blog posts, and you can always send us an email, too, at podcast@weeklyleader.net, and if you attach a small audio file of 5 meg or less, we'll find a way to bring it into the show. You can get us on Twitter, and the Weekly Leader ID is @weeklyleader, Pam is @PamFR, and I'm @PeterMello, and it's PeterMello. All of our other bloggers and podcasting partners are also, their show IDs will be over there, too. You can also comment on the regular blog, which is weeklyleader.net. And we have a team of passionate leadership writers over there. They'd love to have you engage in the conversation. So find a post you enjoy and join the conversation. If you use iTunes, we'd really appreciate it if you went over there and rated and reviewed the podcast. That would be fantastic. We always use PodSafe music. The intro is Transcends by Trance Blackman. And this week we're using music from the Ariel Publicity website. We get an email from them with some new bands. And this song is Where's the Line by Spy for Hire. Hope you enjoy it. So thanks for investing your valuable time with us. And we look forward to being with you again next week.
Think about the strangers that you love. They're hiding in the places you don't know. They don't move, and they don't speak. It's time to choose. Don't stop to think.
Leave behind the places that you know. Throw behind a match before you go. Your friends will lie, your lovers cheat. It's time to move, don't drag your feet. Where's the last hope for you? Dressed in white, soaked in blue. Where's the line I thought we drew? Come inside, stop your shoes. I thought we drew.